Today, we welcome Yola to Morning Becomes Eclectic, where she has prepared an intimate stripped-down performance. Good morning, Yola.
Hi.
It's so wonderful to have you back at KCRW, and we're really excited to hear you.
Thank you so much for having me. I've brought my buddy of mine, Dan Kramer, to play some songs from my debut album. And the first one we're going to play for you is called Lonely the Night.
Lonely the night, lonely the night, be lonely.
I need a whole load of assistance putting this guitar over my afro. this next one we're going to do for you, it's called Ride Out in the Country. Oh, eating my hand. 1, 2, 3, oh. To being on fire, and a literal and a figurative one, this one is. It's called Walk Through Fire.
I gotta walk through the fire. I gotta do.
thinking about the trip to come. My bags are packed and I'm ready. I think I'm gonna make a run, oh Lord. You know I'm gonna make a run. The red hot coals are calling, and I know it's the only way. Ain't no use in prolonging the fact that I just can't stay.
Thank you.
you so much. Now, from my kind of peak drama situation, we're going to lift it up a little with a song called Still Gone. One, two, three, and...
Good to see you.
Oh, it's awesome to see you.
Since we first met at South by Southwest, by the way, YOLA for Morning Becomes Eclectic on KCRW, I'm Ann Litt, and I first met you at South by Southwest, and when I met you, I realized at the time, because I listened back to our conversation, that I had only heard your music about 3 weeks prior to that.
Oh, so,
that was sort of February of this year.
Mm-hmm.
What a magical journey you've had since South by Southwest. How is that?
It's busy as heck. There are no breaks.
Yeah.
There's zero chill. Every single day, something else nigh on unbelievable occurs. And I just have to deal with it and get the heck over it real quick.
Well, there's something about your great attitude and your optimism. And I never have seen somebody run around South by Southwest as much as you did this year. So
yeah, that was unreal. 16 appearances in 7 days.
Yes. And you live to tell the tale.
Yeah, apparently. I think when I wake up in the morning, I'm not really alive until midday. So we're getting there. You know.
All right, well, let's talk about the album a little bit. You worked with Dan Auerbach,
mm-hmm.
and that must have been a pretty interesting experience. He actually reached out to you, didn't he?
Mm-hmm. I'd been playing some showcases around Nashville, and I did that maybe the year before we made contact. And my name did a little circle of Nashville, got into some meetings, met all the kind of people that I don't ever want to have to work with. And then,
oh, yeah.
And then second time round, I was like, okay, let's be a bit more selective this time. Give some no's. And my name did a bigger circuit, so I was able to do a little bit of that. And in that little circuit, someone said, can you get a video to us so we can send it across to Dan because we think he's going to like it. So my manager, Charlie Pierce, she filmed one of my showcases and sent it over. And he was like, can we get her in the studio? Like, I don't know, now. And so they looked at his diary and they're like, you do know that you're a workaholic, right? You're always busy. You're always busy and you love that studio. So the next opening was a couple months. And so I flew back home and then, you know, did the usual, get all your stuff together. And just as by the time I'd done that, I was back out on the plane again to write the first tracks of this record.
So
actually,
you hadn't written it until you got to Dan's studio?
No. Well, there's one song that we had, that I had written before meeting him.
Right.
And which is the one we were going to end on.
Oh, good. All right, good preview. What inspired you about working with him?
Well, I'd actually been a fan of his record, Waiting on a Song. Mm. And I'd been singing Stand By My Girl just to myself. And I was like, oh, yeah, I'm going to cover that one day. And I was like, I just love the sound of the record. Like, I understand at that point he hadn't long had the kind of house band that he'd had, the setup that he'd had. He'd been working a long time to get exactly the kind of nuance of equipment and space that he wanted and people that he wanted to be available. And that felt like it culminated in this work somehow. I could hear it. I could hear the endless layers of production and just the delicate choices that were being made. And I was like, I really need to do a record with this guy. Wouldn't that be nice? And this was just like 2016, before I'd met him the next year. And so that was somewhat, maybe me putting it out into the ether, you know.
Well, that's what they say you're supposed to do.
Right?
Yeah. Did you, he brought a lot of collaborators and writers into the studio, some of whom are legends.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
Oh, gosh. So I was pretty much, in a bunny in headlights type situation, you know, like for a little while. Because every time the door opened, I'm like, who the hell is it going to be now? Oh, my God, who is it? And then one time we opened the door and Dan Penn walks through the door.
Yes.
And I'm like, oh, for the love of God. Is that who I think it is? And, you know, like everyone expects you, especially, you know, when you're a black woman, to be this eternally strong black woman. I was just terrified. Like, it took me a long time to get over that little arc of fear and into, okay, should we do something now?
Yeah, Dan Penn, by the way, one of the great songwriters of all times, part of Muscle Shoals.
Yeah, you might know a song like Dark End of the Street or something.
Yes.
Yeah, you know, a little known song. Yeah, and so I was a fan. Obviously, I'd grown up singing like Do Right Woman and stuff.
Sure.
And so I was really a fan of him and obviously Spooner Oldham and their connection. And so I knew his face and I was very much taken aback. And the whole experience, that and the recording experience, was just this roll call of legends.
Yeah.
And I think that's what he'd been building this whole time.
Yeah.
This resource of people who had been the framework and the fabric of contemporary music, certainly in this country. And putting that in one place.
Yeah.
And especially with his eclectic tastes and mine, that was the perfect place to be.
Well, let's talk about being a black woman in Nashville.
Mm-hmm.
How does that
and
happen?
A Brit.
And a Brit. And loving country music and soul music.
Mm-hmm.
And what was that like? How did you end up there in the first place? Actually, we're doing this on Facebook Live, and people have been submitting questions, and I actually want to work one in right now because Kate Nelson is asking, how did you break through into the U.S. country scene, which is pretty much what I just asked you.
Ah, well, I don't know if I did break through into the music. I'm described so much. We're on a show about eclecticism, and I try my utmost every single day of my life to extol the virtues of eclecticism and to not hem myself in. You know, don't fence me in is how I feel about music all the time. And so any imprint that I made on country was sheerly out of my love of it. The colours that you hear in the songs that I'm playing.
Was it a dream to go to Nashville?
Yes. Yeah. Like, since I was a child, it was a dream to go to Nashville. But it never seemed realistic.
Right.
And, like, I was doing, this was way back in my maybe more songwriter days. I was also kind of part of a band, but a lot of my income came from songwriting. And we were traveling back across America after doing some work here, actually. Well, kind of down in Long Beach. And then we thought we'd write our way back. And I noticed when we hit Nashville that because it was still at that time quite small, so the whole, there's this new area called the Gulch, and it didn't exist, so which was essentially downtown, and a decent 50% of what is now, you know, the city of Nashville, which just wasn't there. And so the way that people interacted was so, like, smaller city, small town, local feeling. And so if you did something, like wrote a good song, then everyone would hear about it. Because everyone would go to the same lunch spot and they go, hey, so-and-so from this publisher and this publisher all went to the same place. And they don't have a conversation. Oh, who have you got in today? Oh, I've got so-and-so. Oh, right, okay. And then they go back to the office and they'd get on the phone and speak to someone here or in New York and go, oh, so what have you been up to? And all those little side conversations meant that your name spread a lot further just because of the serendipity of being in Nashville and in an environment that was the entirety of the music industry on one street, just smooshed together. When I noticed how much difference that made, it wasn't just a matter of a dream, it was a necessity to be there. And I knew that if I landed there with just some idea of what the heck I was going to do, that I'd be able to make a decent start at getting some kind of recognition. Because one thing seems to be true, and we criticize in music industry for bowing and kowtowing to trust fund kids and the like, but you still need to be a boss to survive in Nashville.
Well, you know, a lot of your music is about empowerment, and there are two things I want to talk about, which are the song Walk Through Fire, which you alluded to when you introduced it, but also this the work you have been doing with the High Women and the Newport Folk Festival. That's just now. Everybody's seen that video a million times. Let me ask you about, why don't we talk about Walk Through Fire, because you said it was a literal and figurative explanation behind that song.
Yes.
And it's all about empowerment. And will you tell that story? Because I think it's really important.
Yeah. I around Christmas 2014, I was wrapping presents in my front room. And one of the presents I was going to be giving was a bioethanol burner. It's like a glorified candle, for all intents and purposes. And you put a tiny bit of bioethanol in the reservoir. And then it makes a pretty little flame, lets off a little heat, nothing dramatic, but, you know, it's a cute thing. And so there I was, filling up the reservoir to test it, make sure it wasn't faulty, and it worked just fine. Yeah, well done for laughing, whoever that was. a little trickle came out of the reservoir because it worked fine, but the canister that had the bioethanol was faulty and leaking. And so the flame caught the canister, and then the canister went up. Poof! And then another little trickle that clearly been dripping on my sleeve and the bottom of my dress the whole darn time caught, and I go, whoo! Up I go. And I'm, as I'm burning, it dawns on me that one, obviously. But, you know, my second thought is, you know, I'm going to have to think of something to get me out of this whole static shock situation because, you know, they say you're fight or flight. I wasn't either. I was bunny in headlights. And so I had to think of something worse than being on fire. And I thought of the first 30 years of my life. Say that real quick, huh? And I realized that I hadn't really experienced happiness properly until maybe like the last kind of couple years of that time, so like 30 to 32, was like just this real setting free moment for me. And I'd really kind of made some like social culls in my life. I'd really, you know, I call it the 29 panic, you know,
yeah.
When you just like go, this is not sustainable. And you make some serious cuts. And I'd just been in this environment of just utter joy. And it dawned on me that I was so happy that I'd take my life at that point plus fire any day of the week over the life I'd been in a couple of years previous minus fire. And that made me laugh so hard that it laughed me out of shock. And and then I was like, oh yeah, stop, drop and roll. So I stopped, dropped and rolled, and you know, I'm not dead, which is really nice. And I feel really great all of a sudden, like, yes, life. And I hadn't mentioned this in the story, but part of that realization was that I'd been homeless maybe 10 years exactly previous. Well, almost 10 years exactly kind of previous. And I had nowhere to go. I had all these faux amis, you know, all the kind of, sorry, it's not convenient. Sorry. I've got things on the cat cell or something like that.
Yeah.
Like, and so I was living in a big, like, duffel bag in a bush in London for only a small amount of time, but long enough to realize that I really need to reinvent my situation. And at that point, when my house was clearly no longer habitable until they remodeled it, I had so many places to go. Mm. I was so loved, and I hadn't been loved. I didn't know what that was like until that moment. And I realized, yeah, I'm surrounded by love. Mm. And so that was so uplifting. I was like, I'm going to start writing songs. I'm going to get back out there. I'd taken a little hiatus from music.
Right.
And so I got back into it. And that's what inspired me to start playing guitar, to start writing, so I could get songs out of my head and, you know, start showcasing. And played AMA UK. And then they invited a bunch of Brits out to play at their events in the US. And that was the beginning of the whole thing, just because it dawned on me that I had the security and love of being able to take a risk and knowing that I wouldn't be alone.
And you haven't looked back.
Not once.
I'd love to ask you a question from one of our listeners. Let's see. Sarah Jade is asking, who would your dream duet be with?
Ooh.
You've already had some dreamy ones.
I've had some really dreamy ones. Oh my goodness, dream duet. Do you know what? I'm really stuck. It's really hard to pick one. I think Elton John is up there with the dream duets. Mm. Do you know what? Yeah. And I'd like to resurrect Aretha. And
you're allowed. You're allowed in the context of this question. And here's another one. Tanya Carlson is asking, how old were you when you started playing guitar and writing your own songs? Because you alluded to going back to the guitar, but how old were you when you started?
Oh, there was no back to the guitar. That's when I started.
Oh.
Yeah.
After the house fire?
Yeah. I was talked out of playing guitar.
By whom?
By just this entire, what I like to call the brotocracy. The top-down, brotocratic environment.
Oh, yeah. I know all about that.
You have no business touching that thing unless you've done it in a quiet little hole and just appeared already shredding. You know, you have to be better than everybody else to be equal. And there are guys that I knew, you know, skinny little white guys who played guitar not that well, who were absolutely fine to do that, but not me. And so I was like, you know, I needed to write, you know, and, you know, strum a little as someone plays a far more superior piano. Thanks, Dan. And, and you know, like, I'm not shy about that. I'm not here to shred, just to get ideas out of my head. But then it dawned on me that that was utterly threatening. Because if I was, as I was in most of the environments I was in, either a top line person or, you know, a co-writer who did the top lines, lyrics and melody to the layman, of course. If I then picked up the guitar, that was all the royalties. So the idea was keep her away from that, keep her in a box, and more importantly, with a soul voice, which you'll, if you think about it, one of the most combinable types of voices you can have. You can put it underneath things, almost any genre you can put a soul voice onto. So keeping me dependent was like anyone's business plan when it came to approaching me. And so, yeah, like I picked it up as a defiant kind of measure. I've got songs in my head. I'm going to get them out. And they're going to stand up against co-writes I've done with legends. And that's going to be enough, you know?
Well, I think I could talk, as I say, every time I speak to you, we could speak for hours. And it's you mentioned one of your dream duets. And I'd like for you to go back in and play us a few more, if you can, and maybe talk a little bit about your dream duet. I'm going to get out of the way. Thank you all so much. It's Yola on Morning Becomes Eclectic.
Thank you so much. Well, I did talk about Elton. As a four-year-old, I grew up listening to Elton as a proud Brit going across the world and showing everyone exactly how fabulous he is. And I grew up listening and singing this song. It's called Goodbye, Yellow Brick Road. When are you gonna come down? When are you going to land? I should have stayed on the farm. I should have listened to my own man. You cannot hold me forever. I didn't sign up with you. I'm not a prison for your friends to open. This boy's too young to be singing the blues.
My future lies beyond.